Chapter 24. Home Again. Denmark blamed for Dutch elm disease. Article in The Arboreal Times, July 17, 1988. Dutch elm disease was nothing of the sort, was the shock claim from leading arborealists last week. For many years, we had blamed Dutch elm disease on the Dutch, declared Jeremy Acorn, head spokesman of the Knotty Pine Arboreal Research Facility. So-called Dutch elm disease, a tree virus that killed off nearly all England's elms in the mid-70s, was thought to have originated in Holland, hence the name. But new research has cast doubt on this long-held hypothesis. Using techniques unavailable to us in the 70s, we have uncovered new evidence to suggest that Dutch elm disease originated in Denmark. Mr. Acorn went on to say, "We have no direct evidence to suggest that Denmark is engaged in the design and proliferation of arboreological weapons, but we have to maintain an open mind. There are many oaks and silver birches in England at present unprotected against attack. Arboreal warfare, should we be worried? Full report, page 9. I hurried home to get there before my mother, as I wasn't sure how she'd react to finding Friday was being looked after by a gorilla. It was possible that she might not have any problems with this, but I didn't really want to put it to the test. To my horror, Mum had got there before me, and not just her either. A large crowd of journalists had gathered outside her house, awaiting the return of the Mallet's new manager, and it was only after I had run the gauntlet of 1,000 no comments that I caught her, just as she was putting her key in the front door. "Hello, Mother," I said, somewhat breathlessly. "Hello, daughter. Going inside? That's what I usually do when I get home." "Not thinking of going shopping?" I suggested. "What are you hiding?" "Nothing." "Good." She pushed the key in the lock and opened the door, giving me a funny look. I ran past her and into the living room, where Melanie was asleep on the sofa, feet up on the coffee table, with Friday snoring happily on her chest. I quickly shut the door. "He's sleeping," I hissed to my mother. "The little lamb. Let's have a look." "No, better let him be. He's a very light sleeper." "I can look very quietly." "Maybe not quietly enough." "I'll look through the serving hatch then." "No." "Why not?" "It's jammed. Stuck fast. Meant to tell you this morning, but it slipped my mind. Remember how Anton and I used to climb through it? Got any oil?" "This serving hatch has never been stuck. How about tea?" I asked brightly, attempting to form a misdirection that I knew my mother would find irresistible. "I want to talk to you about an emotional problem that you might be able to help me with." Sadly, she knew me all too well. "Now I know you're hiding something. Let me in." She attempted to push past, but I had a brainwave. "No, Mother, you'll embarrass them, and yourself." She stopped. "What do you mean?" "It's Emma." "Emma? What about her?" "Emma. And Hamlet." She looked shocked and covered her mouth with her hand. "In there? On my sofa?" I nodded. "Doing, you know, both of them together?" "And very naked." "But they folded the antimacassars first," I added, so as not to shock her too much. She shook her head sadly. "It's not good, you know, Thursday." "I know. Highly immoral." "Very." "Well, let's have that cup of tea, and you can tell me about that emotional problem of yours. Is it about Daisy Mutler?" "No, I don't have any emotional problems." "But you said..." "Yes, Mother, that was an excuse to stop you barging in on Emma and Hamlet." "Oh," she said, realization dawning. "Well, let's have a cup of tea anyway." I breathed a sigh of relief, and Mother walked into the kitchen, to find Hamlet and Emma talking as they did the washing up. Mother stopped dead and stared at them. "It's disgusting," she said at last. "Excuse me?" inquired Hamlet. "What you're doing in the living room, on my sofa."
"What are we doing, Mrs. Next?" asked Emma.
What are you doing? Flustered my mother, her voice rising. I'll tell you what you're doing. Well, I won't, because it's too... Here, have a look for yourself. And before I could stop her, she opened the door to the living room to reveal... Friday, alone, asleep on the sofa. My mother looked confused and stared at me. Thursday? Just what is going on? I can't even begin to explain it, I replied, wondering where Melanie had gone. It's a big room, but not nearly large enough to hide a gorilla. I leaned in and saw the French windows were ajar. Must have been a trick of the light.
Trick of the light?
Yes, may I? I closed the door and froze as I noticed Melanie tiptoeing across the lawn, fully visible through the kitchen windows.
How can it be a trick of the light?
I'm not really sure, I stammered. Have you changed the curtains in here? They look kind of different.
No. Why didn't you want me to look in the living room?
Because... I asked Mrs. Beatty to look after Friday, and I knew you didn't approve, but now she's gone, and everything is okay.
Ah, said my mother, satisfied at last.
I breathed a sigh of relief. I'd got away with it.
Goodness, said Hamlet, pointing. Isn't that a gorilla in the garden?
All eyes swiveled outside, where Melanie stopped in mid-stride over the Sweet Williams. She paused for a moment, gave an embarrassed smile, and waved her hand in greeting.
Where? Said my mother. All I can see is an unusually hairy woman tiptoeing through my Sweet Williams.
That's Mrs. Bradshaw, I murmured, casting an angry glance at Hamlet. She's been doing some child care for me.
Well, don't be so rude and let her wander around the garden Thursday. Ask her in.
Mum put down her shopping and filled the kettle.
Poor Mrs. Bradshaw must think us dreadfully inhospitable. Do you suppose she'd fancy a slice of Battenberg?
Hamlet and Emma stared at me, and I shrugged. I beckoned Melanie into the house and introduced her to my mother.
Pleased to meet you, said Melanie. You have a very lovely grandchild.
Thank you, Mum replied, as though the effort had been entirely hers. I do my best.
I've just come back from Trafalgar, I said, turning to Lady Hamilton. Dad's restored your husband, and he said he'd pick you up at 8:30 tomorrow.
Oh, she said, with not quite as much enthusiasm as I had hoped. That's wonderful news.
Yes, added Hamlet more sullenly. Wonderful news. They looked at one another.
I'd better go and pack, said Emma.
Yes, replied Hamlet. I'll help you. They both left the kitchen.
What's wrong with them?
Asked Melanie, helping herself to a slice of the proffered cake and sitting down on one of the chairs which creaked ominously.
Lovesick, I replied. And I think they genuinely were. So, Mrs. Bradshaw, began my mother, settling into business mode, I have recently become an agent for some beauty products, many of which are completely unsuitable for people who are bald, if you get my meaning.
Ooh, exclaimed Melanie, leaning closer. She did have a problem with facial hair, hard not to, being a gorilla, and had never had the benefit of talking to a cosmetics consultant. Mum would probably end up trying to sell her some Tupperware, too. I went upstairs, where Hamlet and Emma were arguing. She seemed to be saying that her dear Admiral needed her more than anything, and Hamlet said that she should come and live with him at Elsinore, and to hell with Ophelia. Emma replied that this really wasn't practical, and then Hamlet made an extremely long and intractable speech, which I think meant that nothing in the real world was simple or slick, and he lamented the day he ever left his play, and that he was sure Ophelia had discussed country matters with Horatio when his back was turned. Then Emma got confused and thought he was impugning her Horatio, and when he explained that it was his friend Horatio, she changed her mind and said she would come with him to Elsinore. But then Hamlet thought perhaps this wasn't such a good idea after all, and he made another long speech, until even Emma got bored and she crept downstairs for a beer and returned before he'd even noticed she'd gone. After a while, he just talked himself to a standstill without having made any decision, which was just as well, as there wasn't a play for him to return to. I was just pondering whether finding a cloned Shakespeare was actually going to be possible when I heard a tiny wail. I went back downstairs to find Friday blinking at me from the door of the living room, looking tousled and a little sleepy. "Sleep well, little man?"
"Sunt in culpa qui officia deserunt mollit," he replied,
which I took to mean, "I have slept very well and now require a snack to see me through the next 2 hours." I walked back into the kitchen, something niggling away at my mind. Something that Mum had said. Something that Stiggins had said. Or maybe Emma? I made Friday a Nutella sandwich, which he proceeded to smear about his face.
"I think you'll find I have just the colour for you," said my mother, picking out a shade of grey varnish that suited Melanie's black fur. "Goodness, what strong nails!"
"I don't dig as much as I used to," replied Melanie, with an air of nostalgia. "Trafford doesn't like it. He thinks it makes the neighbours talk."
My heart missed a beat, and I shouted out quite spontaneously, "Ah!" My mother jumped and painted a line of nail varnish up Melanie's hand and upset the bottle onto her polka dot dress.
"Look what you've made me do," she scolded.
Melanie didn't look very happy either.
"Posh! Murray Posh! Daisy Posh! Daisy Mutler! Why did you mention Daisy Mutler a few minutes ago?"
"Well, because I thought you'd be annoyed she was still around." Daisy Mutler, it must be understood, was someone whom Landon nearly married during our 10-year enforced separation. But that wasn't important. What was important is that without Landon, there had never been any Daisy. And if Daisy was around, then Landon must be too. I looked down at my hand. On my ring finger was a ring. A wedding ring. I pulled it forward to the knuckle to reveal a white ridge. It looked as though it had always been there. And if it had? "Where's Landon now?"
"At his house, I should imagine," said my mother.
"Are you staying here for supper?"
"Then he's not eradicated?"
She looked confused.
"Good Lord, no."
I narrowed my eyes. "Then I didn't ever go to Eradications Anonymous?"
"Of course not, darling. You know that myself and Mrs. Beattie are the only people who ever attend, and Mrs. Beattie is just there to comfort me. What on earth are you talking about? And come back. Where do you—"
I opened the door and was 2 paces down the garden path when I remembered I had left Friday behind, so went back to get him. Found he had got chocolate all over his front, despite the bib. Put on his sweatshirt over his T-shirt, found he had glibbed down the front of it. Got a clean one, changed his nappy, and no socks.
"What are you doing, darling?"
asked my mother as I rummaged in the laundry basket. "It's Landon," I babbled excitedly. "He wasn't eradicated, and now he's back, and it's as though he was never gone, and I want him to meet Friday, but Friday is way too sticky right now to meet his father."
"Eradicated, Landon? When?"
asked my mother incredulously.
"Are you sure?"
"Isn't that the point about eradication?" I replied, having found 6 socks, none of them matching. "No one ever knows." "It might surprise you to know that Eradications Anonymous once had 40 or more attendees. When I came, there were fewer than 10. You did a wonderful job, Mother. They'd all be really grateful, if only they could remember."
"Oh," said my mother, in a rare moment of complete clarity. "Then, when eradicatees are brought back, it was as if they had never gone. Ergo, the past automatically rewrites itself to take into account the non-eradication."
"Well, yes, more or less." I slipped some odd socks on Friday's feet. He didn't help matters by splaying his toes. Then found his shoes, one of which was under the sofa, and the other right on top of the bookcase. Melanie had been climbing on the furniture after all. I found a brush and tidied his hair, trying desperately to get an annoying crusty bit that smelled suspiciously of baked beans to lie flat. It didn't, and I gave up. Then washed his face, which he didn't like one bit. I eventually managed to make it out the door, when I saw myself in the mirror, and dashed back upstairs. I plonked Friday onto the bed, put on a clean pair of jeans and T-shirt, and tried to do something, anything, with my short hair. "What do you think?" I asked Friday, who was sitting on the dressing table staring at me. "Aliquippa ex consequat." "I hope that means you look adorable, Mum." "Mollet anim est laborum." I pulled on my jacket, walked out of the room, came back to brush my teeth and fetch Friday's polar bear, then was out the door again, telling Mum that I might not be back tonight. My heart was still racing as I walked outside, ignored the journalists, and popped Friday into the passenger seat of the speedster. Put down the hood, might as well drive in style, and strapped him in. I put the key in the ignition and then... "Don't drive, Mum." Friday spoke. I was speechless for a second, hand poised on the ignition. "Friday," I said, "you're talking..." And then my heart grew cold. He was looking at me with the most serious look I have ever seen on a 2-year-old before or since. And I knew the reason why. Cindy. It was the day of the second assassination attempt. In all the excitement, I had completely forgotten. I slowly and very carefully took my hands off the key and left it where it was. Turn signal blinking, oil and generator warning lights burning. I carefully unstrapped Friday, and then, not wanting to open any of the doors, I climbed carefully out of the open top and took him with me. It was a close call. "Thanks, baby. I owe you. But why did you wait until now to say anything?" He didn't answer, just put his fingers in his mouth and sucked them innocently. "Strong silent type, eh? Come on, Wonder Boy. Let's call SO-14. The police closed the road, and the bomb squad arrived 20 minutes later, much to the excitement of the journalists and TV crews. They went live to the networks almost immediately, linking the bomb squad with my new job as the mallets manager, filling up any gaps in the story with speculation or, in one case, colourful invention. The 4 pounds of explosives had been connected to the starter motor relay. One more second, and Friday and I would have been knocking on the pearly gates. I was jumping up and down with impatience by the time I had given a statement. I didn't tell them this was the second of 3 assassination attempts, nor did I tell them there would be another attempt at the end of the week. But I wrote it on my hand so I wouldn't forget. "Window maker," I told them. "Yes, with an N. I don't know why." "Well, yes, but 68 if you count Samuel Pring." "Reason? Who knows?" "I was the Thursday next who changed the ending of Jane Eyre." "Never read it?" "Preferred The Professor." "Never mind. It'll be in my files." "No, I'm with SO-27. Victor Analogy." "His name's Friday. 2 years old." "Yes, he's very cute, isn't he?" "You do? Congratulations. No, I'd love to see the pictures." "His aunt? Really? Can I go now?" After an hour, they said I could leave. So I plonked Friday into his buggy and pushed him rapidly up to Landon's place. I arrived a bit puffed and had to stop and regain my breath and my thoughts. The house was back to how I remembered it. The tub of Tikkia orologica on the porch had vanished, along with the pogo stick. Beyond the more tasteful curtains, I could see movement within. I straightened my shirt, attempted to smooth Friday's hair, walked up the garden path, and rang the doorbell. My palms felt hot and sweaty, and I couldn't control a stupid grin that had spread all over my face. I was carrying Friday for a greater dramatic effect, and moved him to the other hip, as he was a bit of a lump. After what seemed like several hours, but was, I suspect, less than 10 seconds, the door opened to reveal Landon, every bit as tall and handsome and as large as life as I wished to see him all these past years. He wasn't as I remembered him. He was way better than that. My love, my life, the father of my son, made human. I felt the tears start to well up in my eyes and tried to say something, but all that came out was a stupid, snorty cough. He stared at me, and I stared at him, and then he stared at me some more, and I stared at him some more. And then I thought perhaps he didn't recognize me with the short hair. so I tried to think of something really funny and pithy and clever, but couldn't. So I shifted Friday to the other hip, as he was becoming even more of a lump with every passing second, and said rather stupidly, "It's Thursday."
"I know who it is," he said unkindly. "You've got a bloody nerve, haven't you?"
And he shut the door in my face. I was stunned for a moment, and had to recover my thoughts before I rang the doorbell again. There was another pause that seemed to last an hour, but I suspect was only fractionally longer, 13 seconds tops, and the door opened again.
"Well," said Landon, "if it isn't Thursday next."
"And Friday," I replied. "Your son."
"My son," replied Landon, deliberately not looking at him. "Right."
"What's the matter?" I asked, tears starting to well up again in my eyes. "I thought you'd be pleased to see me." He let out a long breath and rubbed his forehead.
"It's difficult."
"What's difficult? How can anything be difficult?"
"Well," he began, "you disappear from my life 2.5 years ago. I haven't seen hide nor hair of you. Not a postcard, not a letter, not a phone call, nothing. And then you just turn up at my doorstep, as though nothing has happened, and I should be pleased to see you."
I sort of breathed a sigh of relief. Sort of. Somehow I'd always imagined Landon's being uneradicated as just a simple sort of meeting each other after a long absence. I hadn't ever thought that Landon wouldn't know he'd been eradicated. When he was gone, no one had known he'd ever existed, and now that he was back, no one knew he had gone. Not even him. "Ever heard of eradication?" I asked. He shook his head. I took a deep breath. "Well, 2.5 years ago, a Chronopt member of SO-12 had you killed at the age of 2 in an accident. It was a blackmail attempt by a Goliath Corporation member called Brick Shithorse."
"I remember him."
"Right. And he wanted me to get his half-brother out of the Raven, where Bowden and I had trapped him."
"I remember that, too."
"Okay. So, all of a sudden, you didn't exist. Everything we had done together hadn't happened. I tried to get you back by going with my father to your accident in 1947, was thwarted, and chose to live inside fiction while little Friday was born, and return when I was ready, which was now. End of story." We stared at each other for a long moment that might also have been an hour, but it was probably only 20 seconds. I moved Friday to the other hip again, and then finally he said,
"The trouble is, Thursday, that things are different now. You vanished from my life. Gone. I've had to carry on."
"What do you mean?" I asked, suddenly feeling very uneasy.
"Well, the thing is," he went on slowly, "I didn't think you were coming back. So I married Daisy Mutler."